China's influence is rising, but how is it changing the countries around it? From Radio Free Europe, I'm Reed Standish, and this is Talking China in Eurasia, a podcast about how Beijing is changing the balance of power. Emmanuel Macron arrived in China today for a three-day state visit, during which he hopes to dissuade Xi Jinping from supporting Russia's invasion of Ukraine while also developing European trade ties with Beijing. But can the French president's diplomatic push actually succeed? On today's episode, we'll be looking at Macron's China visit, why he's being joined by European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, and what it means for Europe's future relations with China. We'll also be looking at whether Macron stands a chance of achieving this goal of putting distance between Xi and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Helping me figure all of this out is Rickard Joziak, longtime Brussels watcher and Radio Free Europe's Europe editor. So, Rickard, thanks a lot for joining us today. It's always a pleasure to have you on. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I hope you hear me, Reed.
Yeah, coming through. All clear. Thanks a lot. So, Rickard, let's start with the basics. Explain to people, why is this trip happening? How did it come about? What's happened so far? And, you know, what are the story arcs that people should be watching for?
There's a few here, but of course, everything stems from Mr. Xi's visit to Moscow, where he spoke to Mr. Putin, and then the European urge, I would say, to reconnect with China again. So obviously you have, as you said, Madame von der Leyen and French President Macron going together to show a sort of sense of European unity. But you also had, for example, the Spanish Prime Minister going there as well. A week ago, you're going to have the EU foreign policy chief going very soon as well. So this is a sort of sense of the Europeans to reconnect to a certain sense with China again, try to nudge them away from Russia, try to see if they can, in a sense, play a more, for European eyes, a more positive role when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine. So, of course, the Ukrainian issue is left, right and center here for the Europeans. He's trying to sort of make some daylight, perhaps, between Beijing and Moscow. But, of course, Mr. Macron is also arriving in China with lots of French businessmen. So obviously he's trying to strike some trade deals as well. So there's always this sort of thing where there is going to be a difficult diplomatic mission going there. But as always, China is such an important motor economically for the European Union. And I think you will see that as well. So there's a little bit of everything in there. So it's a lot to unpack.
It definitely seems like there's a lot to unpack. And maybe let's start with this dynamic between von der Leyen and the European Commission and their China policy. And then also, I mean, Macron, his French delegation, and just kind of where all those other European interests towards China seem to intersect. I mean, I think it's worth noting, you know, you do raise that there's this, French delegation of businessmen traveling with them. But also, you know, when German Chancellor Olaf Scholz traveled in late 2022 to Beijing, he, you know, didn't bring along anybody representing the EU. It was just himself and a large block of German businessmen. But I have a lot of questions here. So what's von der Leyen's mission here? And, you know, it seems like she's spinning a lot of plates. So what are all those plates and how does she keep spinning them during this visit?
She obviously made a big China speech last week. And she came up with this sort of phrase that, you know, the European Union doesn't want to decouple with China, which is sort of like, in a sense, what the Americans are trying to do. But she invented this new phrase, which sort of like that we want to de-risk instead. So what does that de-risking actually means? Of course, it means for European businesses, especially in sort of critical infrastructure, to screen more. And the European Union is about to start screening of Chinese investment. But on the other hand, it also means that export, especially of sensitive material to China, probably will be screened as well in the future. That's an interesting development, actually. But as always with the European Union, there's one step to the left and one step to the right. And she also talked up the possibilities of doing trade with China, especially in sort of green energy and stuff like that. So it's very interesting to see where the European Union is trying to fit into this. They're not as hawkish as the Americans. And of course, many European eyes are looking transatlantic and see what potentially can happen in America next year with an election year, and thinking that, you know, we might have another Trump coming next year, and it could be good not to put all our eggs in one America-sized basket. And that's, I think, exactly what the French are trying to look at as well, that the European Union is still trying to find some sort of strategic autonomy that the French love to talk about so much. And this trip can be seen in this aspect as well. Not any sort of chance of decoupling, but to sort of see where the Chinese are and see if they can play, especially the French can play, a diplomatic role internationally, which they are so much seeking.
Well, that's super interesting, Rickard. I'm always curious about how, you know, this line that Brussels and, you know, different European heads of state seem to be walking in regards to China, because, I mean, I feel like it's always a bit difficult. It's a tough tightrope to walk in the best of times. But, you know, that path is getting narrower and narrower, it seems like. And, you know, going back to talking about von der Leyen's speech, you know, I think it was quite notable. I think it caught a lot of headlines for, you know, being tougher than I think than what we're used to seeing coming out of Brussels of late. I know you mentioned a few of those points, but I know she also stated quite clearly that, you know, this future relationship with China will be dictated by China's, you know, how China behaves around Russia's invasion of Ukraine. You know, that will determine the course of things between Beijing and Brussels. But I'm really curious, you know, what did you make of this speech? Did it come across as too tough for you? Is it reminiscent of other things? And what might that tell us about, you know, where that line might lie ahead? You know, especially as you said, there's all these things on the horizon, you know, from the US election to, you know, the broader European economy.
You know, Reid, I was Brussels correspondent for a very long time in a previous life. And it reminded me so much of Western European politicians and how they spoke about Russia, let's say going back 3 or 4 years before the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. It's the same sort of thing that they sort of, you know, at one hand they praise Russia, say, and always talking something historical figure. It could be Dostoevsky or Pushkin or Tolstoy. And it was the same here with von der Leyen's speech. She talks about Confucius and about different inventions that China have done. And then it's always a critical part where they talk about human rights violations and the threatening of neighbors. She mentioned Taiwan very clearly and so on. And so did the Europeans when they talked about Russia before, about, you know, Russia menacing its close neighborhood, whether it was Georgia or Moldova or Ukraine. And then it sort of also comes back, though, again, to sort of things where we can still do business at. For her, obviously, still being driven very much by a green agenda. It's about, you know, investment in biotechnology and stuff like that. And when it was the Russians, it was always about energy and maybe potentially people-to-people contact. So when I listened to that speech and read it again, it's sort of like you could have changed a few words and it could have been a speech by the previous European Commission president talking about Russia. So I feel that Europeans are very much right now with China where they were with Moscow a few years ago.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say there is a bit of sense of deja vu, you know, that is happening here, both in terms of what you're saying, you know, sometimes some of the same phrases, perhaps, you know, being tweaked slightly and recirculating in speeches. But I mean, also, you know, if we turn a little bit here to look at Macron's visit to China, I mean, he's dubbed this trip as a chance for a reset with China. Obviously, the whole idea of having a type of, you know, big policy reset, that's also very reminiscent of Western policy, I guess, a lot more in this sense of American policy towards Russia, you know, but quite broadly about, you know, trying to get things back on a right page. You know, perhaps there is a path forward that can be worked out. But, you know, I'm quite curious, you know, can you tell people who are listening, you know, how did we get into a place between with Europe and China where we're even in need of a reset in the first place? And I mean, what does that really mean when Macron is saying we need a reset?
I mean, there are two things here. First of all, I would say that the Europeans have rightly, I would say, concluded that if there's one country that can have an impact on Russia, that's China. I think the Europeans are right about that. I think the Chinese are the one power that somehow can nudge Russia in a different direction. But then it's the whole French question as well, or let's call it the Macron question. This president has been on the outlook for a big foreign policy win ever since he became president. And he's an internal optimist. Now, I mean, you remember very well in the run-up to the invasion of Ukraine, the full-scale invasion in February last year, that he was the last European leader who really was pushing and trying and calling Putin and tried to be some sort of, you know, a deal maker of some sort. So I'm not surprised that he's going to China and trying to play the same role here, trying to see if, you know, French diplomacy could work, because in a sense, you know, he is also escaping from a domestic scene that is very turbulent. You've probably seen, and most people who have followed European politics, is that he has had an enormous difficult month when it comes to pension reforms, with constant protests reaching up to millions of people on the streets in various French cities. So he's also escaping a domestic agenda. And right now, he's looking at things from a foreign policy point of view. This is he's not running for any election anymore, so he can try to be a sort of statesman and try to get, you know, in a sense, leaving some foreign policy legacy in place that he so far has been lacking.
Well, you know, that's interesting. You talk a bit about that, you know, leaving a legacy, and also, you know, the domestic situation in France that he, you know, appears to be, you know, perhaps understandably looking to get a little bit of distance from. But, you know, that makes me wonder of, you know, if we look about this from the Chinese perspective, okay, here is this guy. Okay, he's the president of France, which is, you know, it's okay, it's on the Security Council. It's by no means an insignificant nation. But, you know, I think the way that China sees the global playing field is perhaps similar. You know, it's Moscow, it's Washington, it's Beijing. You know, really, it's Washington and Beijing. You know, Moscow, I think, is perhaps getting lowered on the pedestal from the Chinese point of view. So I guess it's also this question of, you know, does Macron have the sway to really pull this off? And, you know, as you said, you know, a big part of this chasm that's formed, you know, between Europe and China is over the war in Ukraine and China's relationship with Russia during that. And so Macron really seems to think that he has this personal touch that can perhaps smooth things over. You know, he's going to also join Xi to Guangzhou, I believe, which is where Xi's father was governor for some time. But, I mean, it does seem like a bit of a gambit to try and drive some sort of wedge between Putin and Xi. So, you know, I'm curious, you know, Rickard, can you tell us, do people in Brussels think Macron is up to the task? You know, what about von der Leyen? Can she help out in this in any kind of way? Can she be the bad cop to Macron's good cop?
I think one of the reasons she's going there is, in a certain sense, to rein him in a bit. Because if there's one thing that the Chinese, I think, would like to do with the Europeans, is to split them a bit, right? To divide and conquer. And that is sort of the reason, I think, as well, why she was so insistent on going on this trip. And of course, Macron invited her and so on, and she was very quick to seize it. Because I mentioned that, oh, you know, the Europeans are trying in some way to see if there's some daylight between the Chinese and the Russians. But very much what the Chinese would want, if anything, it's to create daylight between the United States and Europe. And probably the best avenue of doing that is to create the wedge, especially between Western Europeans, notably France, but also other trading partners that are trading a lot. I'm thinking about Italy, for example, maybe Spain, and the more hawkish Central Eastern Europeans, especially the Baltics. So I am sort of wondering if the Europeans really have thought this through, quite frankly. But in the same time, I do think that it's a good point for them to talk to the Chinese. And even the Baltics have come out and said that, you know, we want channels of communication with China. China is too important. So let's see what comes out of this. But I think it's a rather perilous trip that might happen, you know.
Right. I mean, that's obviously, you know, given the state of relations, especially, you know, broadly China and the West, but especially we talk about China and the United States, I mean, things are in quite a rough state. I think probably perhaps one of the roughest states they've been in the modern period. So there's obviously no harm in trying to walk things back at all. But I think what you said, I mean, that's kind of the flip side here of this question. You know, Macron is allegedly going to Beijing to try and drive a wedge between Xi and Putin. But I think perhaps from Xi's point of view, he's welcoming Macron to try and drive a wedge between Europe and the United States. And it's kind of, you know, who's the better statesman, perhaps, at the end of the day, and who has more sway, which, at least when it comes in the sway section, I mean, where do you stand about it? I guess that gets into an interesting question, Ricardo. I mean, is this kind of a very, you know, a mutual need? There's a kind of symbiosis here, or, you know, I mean, China obviously wants access to the European market, but I mean, does the EU need China more than China needs Europe at this point?
I would say so, yes. I mean, like, the Europeans obviously have a trade deficit with China. It's growing by the day, right? So we Europeans still need the Chinese very much. But I'm going to go back again to the nervosity that is very clearly existing in Brussels when it comes to the United States in next year. You know, the Biden presidency have given the Europeans some respite, and they're usually seeing eye to eye on most things. But they are nervous about, in a sense, being too dependent on America that suddenly can flip next year. And that is a problem for the Europeans. They're looking for different ways of still keeping up this international rules-based order. And so far, the Americans are with the Europeans on that. But they're nervous that they once again might find themselves quite isolated. And that's where they probably need to cozy up to other partners as well. And then, of course, there is the question of Ukraine as well, and how long the Europeans really can sustain that as well, with sanctions, with the fact that energy prices are, you know, can skyrocket as well. There's going to be another difficult winter next year, inflation and so on. So the Europeans are in a vulnerable situation, and pivoting a bit again into, you know, a fairly historical deal yesterday with Finland joining NATO, Europe is even more dependent on American security right now. So in that sense, Europe is very much sitting in the American lap, but they're afraid that lap might be shaky if there is a president in the White House that is less Europhilic than the current one.
Right, and I guess as perhaps a refresher to people listening, I mean, if we think of, you know, 4 years of the Trump presidency, we saw relations with, you know, I think bilaterally with several European countries get a bit rocky, but I think especially with the European Union, things got quite rocky. We had trade disputes. You know, as Biden was coming in during that transition period, that's when the EU and the Chinese signed this big sweeping comprehensive trade pact, which was heralded as this, you know, kind of big blow, and I think was very much reflective of the times. And I mean, obviously, under the Biden presidency, we've seen perhaps some of those wounds get healed a bit and some of those anxieties get calmed. But I guess you're getting to this broader point, which, you know, this seems to operate on a 4-year cycle, and Europe also needs to be thinking about long-term things. And when you do that, you need to hedge your bets a bit when we're talking strategically. But Ricard, I want to get back a little bit to something we were getting to earlier and talking about Emmanuel Macron and how he sees this whole issue. You know, you talked about it perhaps being a bit of a legacy issue for him. There's obviously a lot about how this is perhaps seen domestically. But, you know, I can remember reading interviews by him, you know, going back several years, well before the war in Ukraine started, and especially even at times where, you know, this kind of idea that Beijing and Moscow are as close as they look now seemed a bit, you know, some people were pouring cold water on that idea. But, you know, he's been saying for a long time that this is bad news for Europe, the idea of Beijing and Moscow being so close, and that, you know, it's kind of Europe's job to keep them as far apart as possible geopolitically. But, I mean, I guess it just comes down to is this possible? Does he have the diplomatic goods to do it? What do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think he's not a heavyweight enough. And it's interesting that you mentioned those old articles, because actually then the idea was, of course, to pull Russia away from China as well, and perhaps sort of create this sort of the old idea of a common European house again, and sort of engage with Russia. And there were even thoughts about, you know, recreating old EU-Russia summits. That was a year before the actual war broke out or the invasion happened. The French and the Germans very much wanted to sort of restart, you know, EU-Russia summits. That had been something that was a sanctioned things before. So that was his idea back then. So I think he's just desperately looking for something that can be a foreign policy win, as I said before. But I don't think really what would he technically offer to the Chinese that would make them get away from Russia? Because right now, the Chinese, I would say, have Russia exactly where they want them, you know, like as a junior partner, as a country at the borders that can supply especially energy and certain other raw materials. And I don't think the Chinese will give up on that. This is a long-term strategy, and Russia will, in a certain sense, become that sort of client state to the Chinese, which is something Europe, in a sense, never will. So I don't really see the French offering anything apart from business opportunities that the Chinese, quite frankly, can get in other parts of larger Eurasia as well.
Right. And I mean, you're talking a lot about, you know, that dynamic between Beijing and Moscow. And I think that something else that's worth pointing out is, I think that there is a very genuine belief in Beijing that the West is out to get it. You know, it's mostly the United States, but I do think Europe fits into this from a Chinese point of view. And I think that there's certainly a Chinese goal, you know, wanting to split off the Europeans and the Americans. But at the end of the day, that I think that's how Chinese see the world, and especially see the world in the future. And that's why Russia is such an important country to keep by its side, is because, okay, that Russia is the only other real country that's willing to stand with China and kind of resist in this same way. So, you know, is there really anything that Europe can offer to offset that need that the Russians fill? So that gets to, I guess, my next question, Rickard, which is, I mean, it really does seem that, you know, given all that we've said, all that we've covered, Macron and von der Leyen, you know, they're really facing some impossible tasks here. And so I'm curious, you know, where do you see this all going? You know, obviously, this visit, it's a 3-day visit. It's kicking off today. But what happens, you know, if this whole thing falls apart? Macron, von der Leyen, they return back to Europe. They leave China. And, you know, then we see Xi or someone else high up in the Chinese Communist Party signal back to Russia to show that strong support, you know, kind of counter all of the show that they just saw by hosting these two.
I think the most important thing is not to lose face, and anything else than that, you know, will be seen as a success. But I think what the Europeans are looking at, and the first thing is actually, I think that what von der Leyen sort of hinted a bit in her speech as well, is the an updated KAI, this investment agreement we talked about that is stopped in the European Parliament. She mentioned that we can perhaps, you know, look at that again and see if we can sort of strike some sort of deal, of course, taking into the security concerns that the Europeans have. So I think she can try to sell that as sort of some sort of new trade deal going forward. And another thing I think they can do as well is sort of try to sell, as you know, the communication channels are open, is some sort of EU-China summit in Brussels or elsewhere later this year. But of course, that's going to happen first after the EU-US summit that I think is likely to happen sometime in this summer, June, July, perhaps. So I think that the things they will look at is to see if there is some sort of trade issues, some sort of trade gains to get, and then, of course, to sort of keep channels of communications open, especially on the highest level with some sort of summit in Brussels or Beijing later in the year, and then potentially strike some sort of deal on environmental issues as well. That's always an easy, low-hanging fruit to reach for.
Okay, Rickard, thanks a lot. So I'm going to pivot now, and we're going to take some questions from listeners. And that's also a reminder to anybody who is listening live right now. If you have a question that you would like to ask, please raise your hand, and we can either get to you live or, you know, you can send it to one of our accounts and we can answer it in writing. So this is a question that was sent in, you know, ahead of our podcast here today. This is from Stephen Jones. So Stephen wants to know that given that China's economy is slower than it used to be, is it safe to say that the implied threat of secondary sanctions, either from the United States or the EU against China, is actually working in tempering any kind of public support from China to Putin amid the war? Rickard, what do you think about that?
I think potentially US secondary sanctions can work. I think the Americans are quite good at that. I know that the Europeans hated the US secondary sanctions when they first occurred because they were afraid that their own companies would be caught. Right now, the Europeans are probably looking into that as well. But I don't think they will be serious about that. So potentially U.S. secondary sanctions could sort of dissuade the Chinese a bit. European sanctions, no, I don't think so.
Right. And I mean, I think that we've seen that play out, quite a bit already. And I thought it was interesting. I don't know, Rickard, if you caught this, but Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba, he gave an interview, I want to say it was last week, to the Financial Times. And in there, you know, he raised, said a few interesting things, one of which is that, you know, he doesn't think that China has decided whether it wants to be a peacemaker in Ukraine or not yet. It hasn't made up its mind on what role it wants, which I thought was interesting. Obviously, you know, in the lead up to that Xi Putin summit in Moscow that we just had a couple weeks ago, there was a lot of chat that perhaps, you know, Xi was ready to break his official unofficial silence, I should say, with Zelensky, who he hasn't spoken with since the invasion happened over a year ago. But of course, that phone call's never come about. And it seems that, you know, that was, again, put on offer a little bit and didn't come. Also in that interview, it was interesting that Kuleba said that he had a conversation with his counterpart in China, the Chinese foreign minister, and said and was told or reassured, he said, that China had no plans to officially send weapons to Russia to fight in Ukraine. But of course, we have seen all these looks at custom data, various kind of reports that have come up that are showing that at least there is, you know, kind of private companies, Chinese companies, which, you know, whether what kind of links they might or how they might be perhaps asking or acting on behalf of the state, we're not exactly sure. But there is, you know, whether that's, you know, small scale shipments of assault rifles, body armor, helmets, drones, things like that, that is taking place already. But I guess that's not the kind of stuff that triggers secondary sanctions. So perhaps that, given that's all we're seeing, I guess we can say that I guess the U.S. ones are having some sort of effect. But Rickard, I have a question for you. Get your thoughts on this. You know, in regards, again, this idea of China playing some kind of peace role, obviously the Chinese have been floating this peace plan. You know, it was at the end of February when they rolled this out, this 12-point proposal that they had. But I mean, what's your sense, you know, on the reception in Brussels to this kind of idea? Is anyone seriously seeing Xi and China as a peacemaker? And do you think that that's something that, you know, Macron would want while he's during this trip to China? Or is it simply to show up in China and send this message of, hey, don't get any closer than you already are?
I mean, this whole Chinese peace plan got pretty lukewarm reception in Europe. I mean, it was sort of like laying the blame on both sides, so to speak, and not even Europe can accept that. I think, however, that one of the things that Macron could get as a win going to China is to persuade Xi to actually pick up the phone and call the Ukrainian president to you know, make sure that Zelensky and Xi are actually talking to each other. That would be potentially a European win, and that could potentially lead to something going forward. But that's about it. You know, I think that when it comes to the Chinese as well, and this red line of the West that we talked about when it comes to sort of, for example, sending weapons. And that's another thing, you know, like, okay, they might not be sending big, obvious weapons, but what about sort of artillery pieces or bullets? Right now we're seeing, you know, what's likely to be a war of attrition in Ukraine, and the potential bullets coming from China can easily be the one that sort of holds the war for Russia, you know. So that's another thing as well that I'm always curious about how the West, both Europeans and Americans, react to. Semiconductors is another thing, chips, all these sort of things that might not be weapons but will contribute to the Russian war effort, and that the Europeans or the Americans are not really sort of pushing the Chinese on. That's in a sense, if they can't solve that, I don't see how the Chinese can be you know, a voice for, you know, negotiations in this war at all.
Right. I mean, I guess it gets back to this whole thing of, you know, how can China really, what kind of mediating or negotiating role can it really play, given that it's quite clearly staked out aside? Okay, we're going to go to a live question now. Pyotr Kurzin, who is a regular contributor here. Pyotr, you have a question. What do you want to know?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for that, Reid. I guess my main question or point of contention, not necessarily with what's been said, but just to drill down a little bit further, is, you know, can we really take anything that the CCP says at face value? They have benevolent neutrality, and they're not, you know, an actor that I think is acting in good faith. So can we really, given everything else that's been going on with the peace deal between Saudi Arabia and Iran, really believe that the peace deal that was proposed for Ukraine and Russia is even in their interests? It's mainly just, I think, China wanting to be seen as a peace broker. It's more about Chinese interests or optics than the actual deal. I'm just curious what yourself and Ricard would feel about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, I think you're, I mean, obviously totally right that a big part of this is optics. It's wanting to, you know, show how China behaves as a global power, you know, what its kind of diplomatic brand is, so to speak. I think that's a big part of it. But I do think, I mean, China, I think at this point, given how it's going, how it's progressing for Russia, you know, there's obviously many different minds about this. I mean, personally, I think that the Chinese would want this war to wind down, especially the way it's going and the risk perhaps that it poses to Russia moving forward, and that, you know, that could weaken them even further, you know, and impair them from being this partner to kind of push back on the West globally in the future. But yeah, obviously the way that they're trying to, you know, go about this, I would say, yeah, you know, that's, it's on their terms. It's doing it in a way that's in their interests, which is also sort of in Russia's interests. And that's perhaps why, you know, it's getting such a lukewarm reception, as Ricard said. Ricard, do you want to add in here to Piotr's question?
But just a little bit. I mean, like, the European Union is always trying to give everyone and all actors the benefit of the doubt. That's just the way the European Union works. It's sort of, it's always about sitting down and talking and having a line of communication. That's essentially the European model, right? So they are always willing to talk to anyone who's willing to talk. But it's interesting sometimes when I point out these sort of things, like, well, but what positive signs do you see from the Chinese? And some EU diplomats pointed out to me that, well, you know, in the UN system, they are sometimes playing quite an active and positive role, and always sort of point out, you know, that the Chinese are quite influential when it comes to sort of prolonging UN missions, for example, in Bosnia, the Althea mission, or the Irina mission off the coast of Libya, that are both very important for the EU. And the European diplomats are always very keen to point out that Chinese play a very good role in sort of making sure that these things are green-lighted every year in New York, and to sort of push the Russians to not be a spoiler there. So I do think that the Europeans still, despite everything, are very keen to listen and try to engage the Chinese no matter what.
Piotr, I know you have a follow-up, but I'm just going to throw in one comment before I turn back to you. Yeah, you know, a bit off what Ricard is saying, I think also the Chinese are quite smart in their policy and line towards the Europeans, is I do think that they, you know, try to, you know, give them, show that there can be, even if they don't see eye to eye on things, they can be constructive, as perhaps at the UN, like Ricard was just saying. And I do think that they're, in terms of their messaging, I think that they have been relatively okay with, you know, in terms of, you know, I think just in advance of the trip from Macron and van der Leyen, you know, China's ambassador to the EU, even though he offered some criticisms of van der Leyen's speech that Ricard and I were talking about earlier, he then said that, you know, made a point of saying, oh, Russia and China are not an alliance, and, you know, trying to say that there is distance between them, and kind of giving these breadcrumbs, you know, something to perhaps sustain this idea that this type of wedge that, you know, Macron says he wants to create, perhaps could happen, or perhaps is there already and it just needs to be found. So I think that that's also, you know, whether that's true or not, personally, I don't subscribe to that view that wholeheartedly. But I mean, we're going to have to wait and see. So, Piotr, you wanted to follow up?
Yeah, I mean, I can say to the UN point, I worked on crisis groups, UN team for a bit. And the one thing we came to, well, I came to appreciate is that the Chinese do leverage the multilateral system a lot, even if they don't pretend that they do, they do. But to just that point, I mean, I've been living in DC the past few years, and one of the things that we've seen, obviously, in recent months is is Pelosi's visit over Taiwan, and I'm not going to turn this into Taiwan versus Ukraine context, but how much do you think the variance of the American approach towards China vis-a-vis Ukraine and Russia, it has a role in this? Because Macron has, you know, tried to be the peace broker in the past, and when Putin basically stuck two fingers up at him, and you know, that made Macron incredibly angry. America has continued to do things a little bit more, I don't know if it's intended provocatively, but they don't, I think, help matters. And with this suspected visit of McCarthy, the House Speaker, new House Speaker, I mean, I'm just curious for your take on the US versus European approach and whether or not that has any role in the way China responds, or does it not matter? They just look at the West as one collective monolith and that's it. Just wondering what you think about that.
My answer to that would be I don't believe that Beijing sees EU and the US as one collective monolith. I think they're quite actively trying to prevent that from happening. I think they fear the idea that that could happen, and that'd be working in tandem. I mean, I think that I think if you look at what Chinese foreign policy scholars and even some Chinese officials have said, you know, they want there to be distance and daylight. It's actually kind of interesting to me because it feels quite reminiscent to what Macron is saying about what he wants to do between Xi and Putin. That's a similar thing that you see, you know, some Chinese foreign policy thinkers saying about what they want to do between Brussels and Washington. So I don't think that Beijing sees them as one cohesive thing, and they want to keep it that way. Rickard, do you have anything to add on
that? No, I totally agree with you. I mean, I think one of their main policies is actually to create that daylight across the Atlantic Ocean.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap things up there. I want to say a big thank you to Rickard for joining and for everybody who participated and sent in questions and who listened to us live. So thanks again. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the China and Eurasia newsletter and subscribe to this podcast for future episodes. Both come out every other Wednesday. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. And until then, I'm Reed Standish.